of the youth concerning justice for the world, a new paradigm response to the leader's letters to the youth in Western countries. The title of a 90-page book authored by retired British binary economics professor Rodney Shakespeare.
The book addresses the main issues for the world today. For example, there's massive inequality. There are preposterous accumulations of wealth. There's no justice. The exportation of justice is, in fact, in the example that Iran is capable of giving as Iran develops the resistance economy.
The book, to be translated into multiple languages, picks up on two open letters penned by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the wake of a rise in terrorist attacks in 2015, among them the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, which fueled Islamophobia in the West.
Islamophobia started immediately after Islamic Revolution in Iran. Although it surprised many in the world, they didn't have any strategy or plan, following which several false flag operations were created to damage the image of Islam. And it was necessary then to address the issue.
In those letters circulated widely online, Ayatollah Khamenei urged Western youth not to believe prejudiced portrayals of Islam by Western mainstream media or people in power, but to keep an open mind and judge the Muslim faith fairly.
The Muslim community are kind and peaceful people, and it's ridiculous to prejudice a whole huge community just because of the actions of one or two people that aren't following the faith that so many of them believe in, and that it's unfair.
More than anything, Professor Shakespeare's book is an economist's view on some of the biggest issues facing humanity, from the vices of capitalism to climate injustice, and whether Islam is the answer. The final chapter envisages the makeup of a true Islamic economy.
At the heart of an Islamic economy is the use of money, which is genuinely interest-free, not pretend. And when you understand that, when you understand that money is today created out of nothing, the way is open. A massive supply of interest-free money, as long as it goes out and is repaid and cancelled, and you can use it in countless ways.
In a world where Islamophobia, as well as economic and other injustices, are on the rise, Professor Shakespeare argues there is a need for a new reset, a paradigm shift. And it's exactly that paradigm shift, he proclaims, that terrifies the West. Zaid Pourreza, London.
The first shipment of U.S. military supplies has arrived in Ukraine. The military contingent is worth $200 million and includes ammunition. The delivery follows the conclusion of the latest round of talks between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine. Russian troops are massed on Ukraine's border, along with an arsenal of tanks, fighting vehicles, artillery, and missiles amid the U.S.-led NATO buildup near the border with Russia. Moscow has denied planning to invade Ukraine, but the White House believes an attack could come at any point. As the crisis escalates, EU leaders have become increasingly vocal in expressing their discontent at the exclusion from the diplomatic top table.
It's not just the US and Russia. If you want to talk about security in Europe, Europeans have to be at the table, and the agenda isn't just the issues Russia has put on the table.
Many believe that the EU is currently politically divided and lacks a unified approach on the Ukraine crisis. France's President Emmanuel Macron has said that the EU must open its own talks with Russia rather than rely on Washington. Macron hopes to revitalize four-way talks between Russia, Germany, France and Ukraine, known as the Normandy format. However, the Baltic states bordering Russia seek a hawkish approach. On Friday, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania announced plans to send anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine after receiving authorization from Washington. But Germany disagrees with this approach, with its defense minister Christine Lambrecht ruling out arms deliveries.
We have to do everything to de-escalate. Currently, arms deliveries would not be helpful in this respect. There is agreement on this in the German government.
The German defense minister says Ukraine will receive a complete field hospital together with necessary training in February. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has stressed Berlin's policy of not supplying lethal weapons to conflict zones. Berlin is also under pressure from the US and other Western allies to stop the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which will carry Russian gas to Germany and the rest of Europe. EU and US leaders have time and again said the project should be halted if Russia attacks Ukraine. But Germany has warned against linking the natural gas pipeline and the row with Moscow over Ukraine. Meanwhile, the EU was sidelined from talks held last week between Russia and the US, NATO, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. The EU has threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it attacks Ukraine, but the 27-member bloc is divided as to what should trigger sanctions. It seems that as the crisis over Ukraine keeps unraveling, the division among the EU states on one side and that between the EU and the US on the other side is becoming more evident and increasingly widespread.
As COVID-19 restrictions are eased, millions across the EU are returning to work. However, many businesses are struggling to stay afloat due to rising energy prices. The pandemic has resulted in more people working from home than ever before. Their bills are also out of control. EU energy ministers met on Saturday to discuss the crisis.
Être plus efficace.
We need to be more efficient, better interconnected. We need greater solidarity when it comes to security of supply. We need to stop wasting energy and protect citizens from more energy poverty.
Consumers are angry at the EU for not being better prepared to ensure sufficient supplies.
It's getting ridiculous. When you're paying like 150 a month, and you're used to this amount, and then it gets raised to 300, it becomes a problem.
With the pandemic, like you said, it's really difficult because people are struggling economically. They're getting fired from their jobs. Some of them are struggling to find new jobs, and this is coming even more.
Governments in 22 of the 27 EU member states have taken temporary steps to try and support businesses and households, but so-called energy poverty continues to rise.
Many ministers mentioned how the situation beyond the EU eastern borders creates uncertainty on the markets and how the gas flows from Russia have dropped significantly in recent months.
But the European Commission acknowledges Russia has honoured all of its gas supply contracts. Moscow insists it's willing to supply more if new contracts are signed. This has already happened with Germany and Turkey, the Kremlin says. As was stated recently in the European Parliament, perhaps the best way to ensure energy security would be for the EU to stop using Ukraine to provoke Russia. This, as Ukraine is corrupt to the core and at the highest levels, according to the European Court of Auditors, which is the EU's financial watchdog. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There's no end in sight with the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Twice a week, help is sent out by the truckload. Donations made to this charity in West London on their way to families hit hard by the rising cost of living. For other charities, it's an everyday job. Nearly 2.5 million people used a food bank in the UK last year. With inflation now the highest in three decades, charities are warning it's only exacerbating an already dire situation.
The striking thing is how fast prices are rising. Bread up by more than 4%, margarine 27%, eggs more than 5%, and apples up by a fifth. The same with other staples. Put them all together, and you're talking about a sharp rise in the cost of living.
And that's just food. There have also been rises in the cost of transportation, clothing, and energy. Utility bills are expected to go up by 50% in spring, affecting some more than others.
You'll notice it, but it won't affect you too much. The poorest will be most affected by this. Those with the narrowest shoulders are taking the worst of the burden, which we need to reverse to try and make sure it's those with the broadest shoulders to take most of the weight.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect storm of COVID, Brexit, and global supply shortages. The question now is whether the government's proposed ways of mitigating the pressure on the people are enough.
The good news is, so far, the capitalism has started to grow again. It's actually building back up. But they haven't addressed the issue of fairness, and over the next few months, this is going to be particularly painful in Britain. The cost of power, potentially doubling in the next few months, will mean that some people will go into fuel poverty almost certainly.
These are just snapshots from across the country of a resurgence of poverty, and it looks like for many in the UK, things are going to get worse before they might get better. Saeed Purza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, To thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kabat Ahwai. The Yemeni army says it has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which is, by some accounts, the tourism and commercial hub of the Persian Gulf region, at least for now. The Yemeni army has warned foreign firms and investors to leave the UAE, as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. Will the UAE change track, or will it gamble its entire country to continue a losing war along with its big brother, Saudi Arabia? Just one of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight.
A war Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched on Yemen has taken a new twist, with the Yemeni army now opening a new front, the United Arab Emirates. Last week, the Yemeni army fired a number of missiles and drones into the heart of the UAE, usually an oasis of calm in the often volatile region. The Yemenis have done it again, targeting the UAE as well as Saudi Arabia as part of their retaliatory attacks on aggressors.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area.
The Sheikhdom claims it intercepted two ballistic missiles with no casualties on Monday, but it made no comment on any drone or missile attacks. Saudi Arabia has also confirmed some missiles hit south of the kingdom, but says some projectiles were intercepted. The Yemeni army is now warning firms and investors to leave the UAE, as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. A journalist says the Yemeni army aims to hit the UAE where it hurts, the economy.
The UAE is a hub of international commerce and international trade. And in fact, without international global finance, this country would not prosper, would barely even, you know, exist as a modern state.
The strikes are part of reprisal attacks over nearly 7-year-long deadly Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis. Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strike by Saudi war machines that claimed dozens of more innocent lives, including children. The United Arab Emirates is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the war. It remained involved in the aggression despite announcing its withdrawal from the alliance 2 years ago. Now the question is, isn't it time for the Emiratis to think before playing into the hands of Saudis? A political commentator says the recent attacks are a clear message for Sheikhdom to avoid playing its destructive role.
The role of United Arab Emirates in Yemen has been so bad and so damaging and so destructive against Yemeni civilians. And I think that United Arab Emirates, they should be really careful to target Yemen from now on.
Relentless bombing campaigns against Yemen and the blockade of the country have so far proved futile for Riyadh and its allies to achieve their intended goals. It remains to be seen if Emirati leaders will change their course of actions and stop partnering with Saudi Arabia in its long-running war on the Arab world's poorest country and continue to face the consequences of their aggression.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we are Professor of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Daniel Kovalik, joining us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is an activist and political commentator, Laith Maarouf, who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to you both. Laith Maarouf, I'm going to start with you, and let's take a look in your eyes, the strength that the Yemeni army is displaying. As Yahya Suri, the spokesman for the Yemeni army, said, ballistic missiles were fired at the Al Dhafra air base in Abu Dhabi, which is also used by the U.S. It also targeted other sensitive areas, based on the spokesperson of what he said. He said they had also launched drones towards Dubai. At the same time, the Yemeni army launched attacks against Saudi Arabia. So tell us about the strength and the sheer power that the Yemeni army has, so we can get an overview of that.
Well, let's remember that just a few days before this retaliatory attack, the Saudi and Emirati forces bombarded Sa'da province in the north of Yemen and Hudaydah and Sana'a with huge bombs, destroying a prison, killing hundreds of people, using bunker busters to supposedly reach the stocks of missiles and drones that the Yemeni army has. And what do we have as a response? As expected, the Yemenis responded with hellfire and attacking military and economic sites in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi. So this shows us that the intelligence gathering capabilities of the Americans and their vessels in the Gulf is almost null. They were not able to hit any of the stocks of missiles and drones that the Yemeni army holds.
and what we saw by these brazen attacks on multiple Saudi military bases in the south and the air base in the United Arab Emirates, is that the air defenses that the Americans and the Israelis have sold to these vessels in the Gulf are useless. I mean, the videos that we watched of these missiles going up in the air in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and not hitting any target, and some of them even falling back down onto the ground on the civilians and inhabited areas of Dubai and Abu Dhabi, that shows you how, number one, how great the work of the Yemeni army is, and how irrelevant and useless the defensive strategies of both Saudi and Emirates are.
Sure. Now, taking a look, Daniel Kovalik, at the size of the UAE, what is it, about 83,000 square kilometers? The U.S. is by far a lot larger, and we can compare that to maybe a small state in the U.S. Given that perspective, we are looking now at a game changer. The Yemeni army spokesperson has said, we advise foreign companies and investors in the UAE to leave as it has become unsafe, and basically threatening the investment that's happening there, the tourism that happens in that country. Why is the UAE taking a gamble that could cost it the entire country?
Well, we'll see how long they do take that gamble. I think they're taking it for now because they do have pressure on them from the U.S., from Great Britain, Saudi Arabia, Israel, to continue this war against Yemen, which all the parties I just mentioned have some role in. And so the UAE being...
Okay, expand on that if you can. I'm sorry to jump in. When you say they have a role, are they dictating to the UAE what to do? Is that what you mean?
That is my sense, certainly. I don't think the UAE has the capacity to wage any type of war on its own, and probably would not, but that it is getting pressure from these other countries that have a huge say in the UAE because of the financial interests that they have in that country. And so the UAE essentially is acting like a client state here, and that is why they're putting everything, as you say, on the line here. But again, how long they can or will do that is unclear.
Well, Laith Maruf, then, I'm trying to figure out the thinking here. If I'm sitting in the palace there in the UAE or Dubai or Abu Dhabi, wherever they have it, do they understand that the UAE could become collateral damage of this war? Because, again, it's so small, it's within range. The Yemeni army is warning it now, it seems, every few days, withdraw from this war. And it's hitting the UAE deep. And yet they're continuing with this. So are the financial returns worth it in their minds to be pressured by the U.S., by Israel, in this case, and maybe Saudi Arabia also?
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously these states are vessels, but more so when we talk about the UAE, because the UAE is not a country that existed before British colonialism. The area used to be called the Desert of Oman, or the desert of Bahrain prior to the British colonization and the creation of this state. This country there's 10 million inhabitants, but 9 million of them are non-citizens that are foreign workers, which means this is the economy of the country is exaggerated and is dependent on the foreign workers that are servicing international businesses. And this, adds another layer, which shows that the United Arab Emirates is actually one of the few countries in the world that are directly controlled by corporations. When we talk about 9 out of 10 people are foreign workers, who are they working for? They're working for foreign international companies, and those international companies are the ones that make the decisions. And as we see, the Yemenis have done a very smart thing addressing these corporations that actually control the country and saying to them that this state will statelet, as actually the spokesperson of Yemen called it, this statelet will not be a safe business place. And if this continues, and they will lose their money. And many of these foreign workers, if actual, the United Arab Emirates turns into a war zone, they will pack up and leave. Therefore, this country not only is built out of glass towers, but the whole economy of it, the whole existence of it, is a glass tower situation that will collapse very easily. And unfortunate for the Emiratis, because they are not sovereign and they can't take these decisions. The decision will come from these corporations.
No, indeed. Well, in the U.S., there are Democrats, Daniel Kovalik, that are against this war. As a matter of fact, when Joe Biden was running during his campaign trail, he said that he's going to end the war. But recently, Democrats came out and wanted clarification, as they called it, from the U.S. presidents. They said this is vague, what is happening. Congressman Peter DeFazio, one of them, that said that Washington needs to offer more than just vague declarations. I don't quite get what is vague about this when Biden just weeks ago approved the over $600 million in arms sales to Saudi Arabia.
There is nothing vague about it. I mean, to put a finer point on it, Biden lied when he said he was going to stop supporting the war. He knew that the war was unpopular amongst liberals who at least understood what was happening there. This is, as you mentioned at the outset, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and it is being created by this unprovoked war. And it has to be pointed out, this was not started by Saudi Arabia with the help of President Obama, it must be said, because it was attacked by Yemen. It was started because Riyadh did not like the government in Yemen. That is not a basis under international law to start a war, and it has created the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. And so, again, liberals who are paying any attention have been opposed to this war. Biden knew that. So he simply said, I'm going to stop supporting it. And then he went on and continued supporting it. That's what's happened. There's nothing vague about it. He lied, and very few people have held him to account. And even now, there's very few Democrats who are putting pressure on him to stop this.
Let's talk about the unspoken of this war, Laith Maruf. One of the things that people don't realize, and that is a particular flashpoint that has become known as the port of Balhaf, from what I'm reading here. This is basically a seaport, and the UAE, when it began this war, has actually taken this seaport over, this area, so much so that it ousted the governor, and then the locals there are obviously very disturbed by the fact that the UAE has taken over their sovereignty of this particular area. This was once an economic lifeline for Yemenis, but now it's basically a military camp for the UAE. These are the unspokens of the war. And it's a seaport, and it seems like the UAE is very interested in these port towns. Doesn't that show that there's a violation of the sovereignty taking place, not reported, obviously?
Yes, and it goes more than that. You know, I'm glad you mentioned this story, because the Yemeni army and resistance bombed the main UAE base in this port city and leveled to the ground the base, killing hundreds of militias that belong to the UAE and some sergeants and officers that are from the UAE military. And as you know, they were so, you know, angry that they chased away the governor, who is one of their men, you know, so they blamed him for their own failures. And the story here with this port and many of the other ports of Yemen and many of the islands of Yemen, including Socotra and the islands on the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, actually connects to the Zionist colony. And today, in the statements of the Yemeni officials, they said that they have some evidence to direct involvement of the Zionists in the attacks that just occurred a few days ago by the Saudis and Emiratis on Yemen, with that huge massacre of over 300 civilians killed, and said that they are investigating, and if they have
full, you know, confidence in this evidence, they will be retaliating against the Zionist colony. And if you read the Israeli media today, they are really worried because the ballistic missiles and drones of Yemen that reached all the way to Abu Dhabi and Dubai and could reach very easily Eilat and the Naqab Desert and can retaliate on those attacks if proven by the that the Zionists were involved. So this is now going to escalate further than the Americans could ever imagine.
Daniel Kovalik, it's shouldn't be really that surprising when when the attack took place by the Yemeni army the last time around on the UAE, the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett came out and said, "We stand ready to offer you security and intelligence support in order to help you protect your citizens from similar attacks." Are we looking at Israeli direct involvement, as our guest there said, and then for them to also then become a target?
Well, I certainly would not be surprised if there is a direct level of involvement by Israel. Israel is very opposed to the Houthi government in Yemen. It sees it as a threat to its own regional influence, and so I have no doubt that it has a lot of involvement. We probably don't know how much in this war. And yes, if it's proven that it had some direct involvement in this war crime, and that's what it was, a war crime that killed at least 100 civilians, including children, then it is certain that Yemen will retaliate against Israel, and it has a right to do that. You know, there's this bizarre almost assumption that the U.S. and Israel are the only countries in the world that have a right to self-defense, and everyone just has to take a beating. And the Houthis are saying, no, that's not the case. We have the right to defend ourselves. And I think we're going to see more out of the Houthis that are going to demonstrate that.
So to conclude here, Leif Maruf, I'm looking at the drawing board, and I'm saying, okay, the UAE has become a victim. Saudi Arabia, obviously, is in danger. You have, well, Israel's involvement. Israel becomes a target. You have how the regional dynamics have now changed, which could engulf maybe the Persian Gulf region, because you're looking at potential risk to danger, for example, to energy pipelines, production facilities, stock market to have somewhat dipped in Abu Dhabi, and also other stock markets in the region. U.S. citizens warning UAE, their citizens in the UAE to leave, or to be very cautious, I should say, I'll rephrase that. All of the downside of this whole thing outweighs the participation of the bombing campaign that's killing civilians. Why do they continue this war?
Because the Americans lost the war in Syria, lost the war in Iraq, lost the war in Gaza and in Palestine and in Lebanon, and now they only see as the Yemenis as a punching bag to continue proving that they are virile. And what's actually the Yemenis are doing is crushing their they're crushing them hard openly, and what the danger is for all of us in Western Asia here living is that we know that the Americans and their vessels act in coordination on all fronts. We also know that the resistance axis has, since the war on Palestine last year, have said they are also coordinating all their activities. So we don't know an attack on Yemen that is responded to, in Palestine, how it could, roll out in the whole region. We don't also know even if there's a trigger in Iraq or Syria or in Lebanon that could trigger a regional confrontation. And this is where the danger lies between the, supremacy of the Zionists and the Americans, and the reality on the ground that they can't apply this supremacy anymore.
Uh-huh.
And because of this anger that they have, we could, see ourselves in a regional war at any moment.
Indeed. Okay, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but thank you for your contribution, Leif Maruf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Daniel Kovalik, a pleasure. Thank you for your input.
professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, who spoke to us from Pittsburgh. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's recommendations on political groups, particularly the leftist parties, which were affiliated to the Eastern Bloc. Today we are going to continue his advice to the political parties, both affiliated to the West and the East. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini's political belief was strongly based on negation of both the East and the West. His belief was originated in the Quranic principle of La ilaha illallah, which means there is no God but Allah. In view of this, since the very start of his movement against domestic tyranny and foreign hegemony, he focused his struggle against the US and the former Soviet Union. Imam Khomeini said, "We want all Islamic countries to have this feature and the concept that has materialized in Iran to exist in all Islamic countries. That is, all the downtrodden in the world stand against the oppressors, resolve their problems, take their right, and know that the right should be taken." The Imam writes in his testament, "This absurdity and artificial, empty-headedness has caused us not to rely on our thought and knowledge in any issue and imitate the East and the West blindly. Rather, if we have any culture, literature, industry, and innovation, the West-toxicated and East-toxicated writers and speakers will castigate and ridicule them and repress and disappoint our native thought and power. And they would promote the foreign traditions and customs, no matter how cheap and disgraced they are, and would sell them to nations through extolling and praising. I recommend affectionately and humbly to the dear nation that as they have been remarkably saved from many of these traps, and the deprived generation is innovatively active to be alert, awake, and watchful so that the policy players affiliated to the West and the East may not drag you to these international looters with devilish temptations. So, stand uprising with your decisive will, activity, and perseverance to remove these dependencies." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, censuring intellectual and political dependency on the East and the West, advises the deceived groups to join the nation. He writes, "My recommendation to the Muslim groups, which are mistakenly inclined to the West and possibly to the East, and would sometimes support the hypocrites whose betrayal has been disclosed, is to not insist on their mistake, to confess their mistake with Islamic courage and, for God's pleasure, become consonant and companion with the government, the parliament, and the oppressed nation, and save these downtrodden of history from the evil of the arrogant. And keep in mind the words of late Ayatollah Mudarris, the devoted and pure clergy, who said at the dormant parliament of those days, 'Now that we are to be destroyed, why should we be destroyed by ourselves? I too say to you, faithful brothers, in remembrance of that martyr of God's way, that if we are destroyed by the criminal America and the Soviet and meet our God with noble red blood, it would be better than enjoying a luxurious life under the flag of the Eastern Red Army and the Western Black Army.'" Imam Khomeini advises political groups and parties to be admonished by the events of Afghanistan and the stiff resistance of the Afghan nation against the Eastern Bloc. He writes, "One must be admonished by Afghanistan, where the usurper government and the leftist parties have been with the Soviet, yet they have failed to suppress the masses of people. In addition, now the deprived nations have woken up, and it will not take long that this awakening will lead to movement, uprising, and revolution, and they will save themselves from the dominance of arrogant oppressors. And you Muslims committed to the Islamic values can see that separation and detachment from the East and the West is gradually showing its bounties, and the thoughtful native brains have become active and advancing towards self-sufficiency. And what the treacherous Western and Eastern experts used to depict as impossible to our nation has been materialized by the hand and thought of the nation. And God willing, it will materialize in the long run too."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.